or the broccoli to the researcher? Would they travel outside their own perspectives and give her the broccoli, even though they themselves hated it? The 14-month-olds didn't, but the 18-month-olds did. At 14 months, 87% shared the goldfish crackers instead of the broccoli. By 18 months, only 31% made this mistake. By a year and a half, 69% had learned to share what others liked, even if it differed from what they liked. This ability to imagine other people's perspectives rather than getting stuck in our own perspectives is a signature skill of successful givers in collaborations. Interestingly, when George Meyer first started his career as a comedy writer, he didn't use his perspective-taking skills in the service of helping his colleagues. He saw his fellow writers as rivals. When you start out, you see other people as obstacles to your success, but that means your world will be full of obstacles, which is bad. In the early years, when some of my colleagues and friends, even close friends, would have a rip-roaring success of some kind, it was hard for me. I would feel jealousy that their success somehow was a reproach to me. When you start your career, naturally you're mainly interested in advancing yourself and promoting yourself. But as Meyer worked on television shows, he began to run into the same people over and over. It was a small world and a connected one. I realized it's a very small pond. There are only a few hundred people at any one time writing television comedy for a living, Meyer says. It's a good idea not to alienate these guys, and most of the jobs you get are more or less through word of mouth or a recommendation. It's really important to have a good reputation. I quickly learned to see other comedy writers as allies. Meyer began to root for other people to succeed. It's not a zero-sum game, so if you hear that somebody got a pilot picked up or one of their shows went to a series, in a way that's really good, because comedy is doing better. This wasn't the path that Frank Lloyd Wright followed. He was undoubtedly a genius, but he wasn't a genius maker. When Wright succeeded, it didn't multiply the success of other architects. It usually came at their expense. As Wright's son John reflected, "You do a good job building your buildings in keeping with your ideal, but you have been weak in your support of others in their desire for the same attainment." When it came to apprentices, his son charged, "Wright never stood behind one and helped him up." In one case, Wright promised his apprentices a drafting room so they could work, but it wasn't until 7 years after starting the Taliesin Fellowship that he made good on his promise. At one point, a client admitted that he preferred to hire Wright's apprentices over Wright himself, as the apprentices matched his talent but exceeded his conscientiousness when it came to completing work on schedule and within budget. Wright was enraged, and he forbade his architects from accepting independent commissions, requiring them to put his name at the top of all their work. A number of his most talented and experienced apprentices quit, protesting that Wright exploited them for personal gain and stole credit for their work. "It is amazing," D. St. Aubin observes, "that few of the hundreds of Wright's apprentices went on to achieve significant independent careers as practicing architects." George Meyer's success had the opposite effect on his collaborators. It rippled, cascaded, and spread to the people around him. Meyer's colleagues call him a genius, but it's striking that he has also been a genius maker. By helping his fellow writers on The Simpsons, George Meyer made them more effective at their jobs, multiplying their collective effectiveness. "He made me a better writer, inspiring me to think outside the box," Don Payne comments. Meyer's willingness to volunteer for unpopular tasks, help other people improve their jokes, and work long hours to achieve high collective standards rubbed off on his colleagues. "He makes everyone try harder," John Vitti told a Harvard Crimson reporter, who exclaimed that, Meyer's presence spurs other Simpsons writers to be funnier. Extolling Meyer's gift for inspiring greatness in those around him. Meyer left The Simpsons in 2004 and is currently working on his first novel, tentatively titled Kick Me a Million Times or I'll Die. But his influence in the writer's room persists. Today, George's voice is strongly in the DNA of the show, says Payne. And he showed me that you don't have to be a jerk to get ahead. Carolyn Omine adds that we all picked up a lot of George's comedic sense. Even though he's not here at The Simpsons anymore, we sometimes think in his way. Years later, Meyer is still working to lift his colleagues up. Despite winning 5 Emmy Awards, Tim Long hadn't achieved his lifelong dream. He wanted to be published in The New Yorker. In 2010, Long sent Meyer a draft of a submission. Meyer responded swiftly, with incisive feedback. He just went through it line by line, and he was incredibly generous. His notes helped me fix things that were bugging me at the bottom of my soul, but I couldn't articulate them. Then, Meyer took his giving one step further. He reached out to an editor at The New Yorker to help Long get his foot in the door. By 2011, Long's dream was fulfilled. Twice. By the time Meyer released the second issue of Army Man, he had 30 contributors. They all wrote jokes for free, and their careers soared along with Meyer's. At least 7 of those contributors went on to write for The Simpsons. One contributor, Spike Ferriston, wrote a single Simpsons episode in 1995 and became an Emmy-nominated writer and producer on Seinfeld, where he wrote the famous Soup Nazi episode. And the Army Man contributors who didn't become Simpsons writers achieved success elsewhere. For example, Bob Odenkirk is a well-known writer and actor. Roz Chast is a staff cartoonist for The New Yorker. And Andy Borowitz became a best-selling author and creator of The Borowitz Report, a satire column and website with millions of fans. Before that, Borowitz co-produced the hit movie Pleasantville and created The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which in turn launched Will Smith's career. By inviting them to write for Army Man, Meyer helped them soar. "I just asked the people who made me laugh to contribute," Meyer told Mike Sachs. "I didn't realize they would become illustrious." Chapter 4. Finding the Diamond in the Rough. The Fact and Fiction of Recognizing Potential. When we treat man as he is, we make him worse than he is. When we treat him as if he already were what he potentially could be, we make him what he should be. Attributed to Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, German writer, physicist, biologist, and artist. When Barack Obama entered the White House, a reporter asked him if he had a favorite app. Without hesitating, Obama named the iReggie, which has my books, my newspapers, my music, all in one place. The iReggie wasn't a piece of software, though. It was a man named Reggie Love, and no one would have guessed that he would become an indispensable resource to President Obama. Love was a star athlete at Duke, where he accomplished the rare feat of playing key roles on both the football and basketball teams. But after 2 years of failed NFL tryouts following graduation, he decided to shift gears. Having studied political science and public policy at Duke, Love pursued an internship on Capitol Hill. With a background as a jock and little work experience, he ended up with a position in the mailroom of Obama's Senate office. Yet within a year, at the young age of 26, Love was promoted up from the mailroom to become Obama's body man or personal assistant. Love worked 18-hour days and flew more than 880,000 miles with Obama. His ability to juggle so many responsibilities with so little sleep has been an inspiration to watch, Obama said. He is the master of what he does. When Obama was elected president, an aide remarked that Love took care of the president. Love went out of his way to respond to every letter that came into his office. I always wanted to acknowledge people and let them know their voice was heard, Love told me. According to a reporter, Love is known for his exceptional and universal kindness. Decades earlier, in Love's home state of North Carolina, a woman named Beth Tranum decided to go back to school to study accounting. Beth was in her early 30s, and numbers were not her strong suit. She didn't learn to tell time on an analog clock until she was in third grade, and in high school, she leaned heavily on a boyfriend to get her through math classes. Even in adulthood, she struggled with percentages. When it came time to take the Certified Public Accountant, CPA, exam, Beth was convinced that she would fail. Beyond the fact that she had trouble with math, she was facing serious time constraints. She was juggling a full-time job with taking care of three children at home, two of whom were toddlers, both of whom came down with chickenpox within 2 weeks of the exam. The lowest point came when she spent an entire weekend trying to understand pension accounting, and after 3 days, felt like she understood less than when she started. When Beth sat down to take the CPA exam, right off the bat, she had a panic attack when she looked at the multiple choice questions. I would rather go through natural childbirth again than ever have to sit for that exam again, Beth said. She left dejected, certain that she had failed. On a Monday morning in August 1992, Beth's phone rang. The voice on the other end of the line said that she had earned the gold medal on the CPA exam in North Carolina. She thought it was a friend playing a joke on her, so she called the state board later that day to verify the news. It wasn't a joke. Beth had the single highest score in the entire state. Later, she was dumbfounded when she received another award, the National Elijah Watt Sells Award for Distinctive Performance, granted to the top 10 CPA exam scores in the whole country, beating out 136,525 other candidates. Today, Beth is a widely respected partner at the accounting firm Hughes Pittman & Gupton, LLC. She has been named an Impact 25 financial leader and one of the top 25 women in business in the Research Triangle. Beth Tranum and Reggie Love have led dramatically different lives. Aside from their professional success and their North Carolina roots, there is one common thread that unites them. His name is C.J. Skender, and he is a living legend. Skender teaches accounting, but to call him an accounting professor doesn't do him justice. He's a unique character, known for his trademark bow ties and his ability to recite the words to thousands of songs and movies on command. He may well be the only 58-year-old man with fair skin and white hair who displays a poster of the rapper 50 Cent in his office. And while he's a genuine numbers whiz, his impact in the classroom is impossible to quantify. Skender is one of a few professors for whom Duke University and the University of North Carolina look past their rivalry to cooperate. He is in such high demand that he has permission to teach simultaneously at both schools. He has earned more than 24 major teaching awards, including 14 at UNC, 6 at Duke, and 5 at North Carolina State. Across his career, he has now taught close to 600 classes and evaluated more than 35,000 students. Because of the time that he invests in his students, he has developed what may be his single most impressive skill, a remarkable eye for talent. In 2004, Reggie Love enrolled in C.J. Skender's accounting class at Duke. It was a summer course that Love needed to graduate, and while many professors would have written him off as a jock, Skender recognized Love's potential beyond athletics. For some reason, Duke football players have never flocked to my class, Skender explains. But I knew Reggie had what it took to succeed. Skender went out of his way to engage Love in class, and his intuition was right that it would pay dividends. I knew nothing about accounting before I took CJ's class, Love says. And the fundamental base of knowledge from that course help guide me down the road to the White House. In Obama's mailroom, Love used the knowledge of inventory that he learned in Skender's class to develop a more efficient process for organizing and digitizing a huge backlog of mail. "It was the number one thing I implemented," Love says, and it impressed Obama's chief of staff, putting Love on the radar. In 2011, Love left the White House to study at Wharton. He sent a note to Skender. "I'm on the train to Philly to start the executive MBA program, and one of the first classes is financial accounting. And I just wanted to say thanks for sticking with me when I was in your class." A dozen years earlier, after Beth Tranum took the CPA exam, she approached Skender to warn him about her disappointing performance. She told him she was sure she flunked the entire exam, but Skender knew better. He promised, "If you didn't pass, I'll pay your mortgage." Skender was right again. And he wasn't just right about Beth. That spring, the silver and bronze medalists on the CPA exam in North Carolina were also his students. Skender's students earned the top three scores of all 3,396 CPA candidates who took the exam. It was the first time in North Carolina that any school had swept the medals, and although accounting was a male-dominated field, all three of Skender's medalists were women. In total, Skender has had more than 40 different students win CPA medals by placing in the top three in the state. He has also demonstrated a knack for identifying future teachers. More than three dozen students have followed in his footsteps into university teaching. How does he know talent when he sees it? It may sound like pure intuition, but C.J. Skender's skill in recognizing potential has rigorous science behind it. Spotting and cultivating talent are essential skills in just about every industry. It's difficult to overstate the value of surrounding ourselves with stars. As with networking and collaboration, when it comes to discovering the potential in others, reciprocity styles shape our approaches and effectiveness. In this chapter, I want to show you how givers succeed by recognizing potential in others. Along with tracing Skender's techniques, we'll take a look at how talent scouts identify world-class athletes, why people end up over-investing in low-potential candidates, and what top musicians say about their first teachers. But the best place to start is the military, where psychologists have spent three decades investigating what it takes to identify the most talented cadets. Star Search. In the early 1980s, a psychologist named Dove Eden published the first in a series of extraordinary results. He could tell which soldiers in the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, would become top performers before they ever started training. Eden is a physically slight but psychologically intense man who grew up in the United States. After finishing his doctorate, he emigrated to Israel and began conducting research with the IDF. In one study, he examined comprehensive assessments of nearly 1,000 soldiers who were about to arrive for training with their platoons. He had their aptitude test scores, evaluations during basic training, and appraisals from previous commanders. Using this information alone, which was gathered before the beginning of training for their current roles, Eden was able to identify a group of high-potential trainees who would emerge as stars. Over the next 11 weeks, the trainees took tests measuring their expertise in combat tactics, maps, and standard operating procedures. They also demonstrated their skill in operating a weapon, which was evaluated by experts. Sure enough, the candidates Eden spotted as high potentials at the outset did significantly better than their peers over the next 3 months. They scored 9% higher on the expertise tests and 10% higher on the weapons evaluation. What information did Eden use to identify the high potentials? If you were a platoon leader in the IDF, what characteristics would you value above all others in your soldiers? It's helpful to know that Eden drew his inspiration from a classic study led by the Harvard psychologist Robert Rosenthal, who teamed up with Lenore Jacobson, the principal of an elementary school in San Francisco. In 18 different classrooms, students from kindergarten through fifth grade took a Harvard cognitive ability test. The test objectively measured students' verbal and reasoning skills, which are known to be critical to learning and problem-solving. Rosenthal and Jacobson shared the test results with the teachers. Approximately 20% of the students had shown the potential for intellectual blooming, or spurting. Although they might not look different today, their test results suggested that these bloomers would show unusual intellectual gains over the course of the school year. The Harvard test was discerning. When the students took the cognitive ability test a year later, the bloomers improved more than the rest of the students. The bloomers gained an average of 12 IQ points, compared with an average gain of only 8 points for their classmates. The bloomers outgained their peers by roughly 15 IQ points in the first grade and 10 IQ points in the second grade. 2 years later, the bloomers were still outgaining their classmates. The intelligence test was successful in identifying high potential students. The bloomers got smarter and at a faster rate than their classmates. Based on these results, intelligence seems like a strong contender as the key differentiating factor for the high potential students. But it wasn't. At least, not in the beginning. Why not? The students labeled as bloomers didn't actually score higher on the Harvard intelligence test. Rosenthal chose them at random. The study was designed to find out what happened to students when teachers believed they had high potential. Rosenthal randomly selected 20% of the students in each classroom to be labeled as bloomers, and the other 80% were a control group. The bloomers weren't any smarter than their peers. The difference was in the mind of the teacher. Yet the bloomers became smarter than their peers in both verbal and reasoning ability. Some students who were randomly labeled as bloomers achieved more than 50% intelligence gains in a single year. The ability advantage to the bloomers held up when the students had their intelligence tested at the end of the year by separate examiners who weren't aware that the experiment had occurred, let alone which students were identified as bloomers. And the students labeled as bloomers continued to show gains after 2 years, even when they were being taught by entirely different teachers who didn't know which students had been labeled as bloomers. Why? Teachers' beliefs created self-fulfilling prophecies. When teachers believed their students were bloomers, they set high expectations for their success. As a result, the teachers engaged in more supportive behaviors that boosted the students' confidence and enhanced their learning and development. Teachers communicated more warmly to the bloomers, gave them more challenging assignments, called on them more often, and provided them with more feedback. Many experiments have replicated these effects, showing that teacher expectations are especially important for improving the grades and intelligence test scores of low-achieving students and members of stigmatized minority groups. In a comprehensive review of the evidence, psychologist Lee Jussum and Kent Harbor concluded, "Self-fulfilling prophecies in the classroom are real." But we all know that children are impressionable in the early phases of intellectual development. When Dove Eden began his research at the IDF, he wondered whether these types of self-fulfilling prophecies could play out with more fully formed adults. He told some platoon leaders that he had reviewed aptitude test scores, evaluations during basic training, and appraisals from previous commanders, and that the average command potential of your trainees is appreciably higher than the usual level. Therefore, you can expect unusual achievements from the trainees in your group. As in the elementary school study, Eden had selected these trainees as high potentials at random. He was testing the effect of leaders believing that their trainees were high potentials. Amazingly, The trainees randomly labeled as high potentials did significantly better on expertise tests and weapons evaluations than the trainees who were not arbitrarily designated as high potentials. Just like the teachers, when the platoon leaders believed in the trainees' potential, they acted in ways that made this potential a reality. The platoon leaders who held high expectations of their trainees provided more help, career advice, and feedback to their trainees. When their trainees made mistakes, instead of assuming that they lacked ability, the platoon leaders saw opportunities for teaching and learning. The supportive behaviors of the platoon leaders boosted the confidence and ability of the trainees, enabling and encouraging them to achieve higher performance. Evidence shows that leaders' beliefs can catalyze self-fulfilling prophecies in many settings beyond the military. Management researcher Brian McNatt conducted an exhaustive analysis of 17 different studies with nearly 3,000 employees in a wide range of work organizations, from banking to retail sales to manufacturing. Overall, when managers were randomly assigned to see employees as bloomers, employees bloomed. McNatt concludes that these interventions can have a fairly large effect on performance. He encourages managers to recognize the possible power and influence in A, having a genuine interest and belief in the potential of their employees, and B, engaging in actions that support others and communicate that belief, increasing others' motivation and effort, and helping them achieve that potential. Some managers and teachers have already internalized this message. They see people as bloomers naturally, without ever being told. This is rarely the case for takers, who tend to place little trust in other people. Because they assume that most people are takers, they hold relatively low expectations for the potential of their peers and subordinates. Research shows that takers harbor doubts about others' intentions, so they monitor vigilantly for information that others might harm them, treating others with suspicion and distrust. These low expectations trigger a vicious cycle, constraining the development and motivation of others. Even when takers are impressed by another person's capabilities or motivation, they're more likely to see this person as a threat, which means they're less willing to support and develop him or her. As a result, takers frequently fail to engage in the types of supportive behaviors that are conducive to the confidence and development of their peers and subordinates. Matchers are better equipped to inspire self-fulfilling prophecies. Because they value reciprocity, when a peer or subordinate demonstrates high potential, matchers respond in kind, going out of their way to support, encourage, and develop their promising colleagues and direct reports. But the matcher's mistake lies in waiting for signs of high potential. Since matchers tend to play it safe, they often wait to offer support until they've seen evidence of promise. Consequently, they miss out on opportunities to develop people who don't show a spark of talent or high potential at first. Givers don't wait for signs of potential. Because they tend to be trusting and optimistic about other people's intentions, in their roles as leaders, managers, and mentors, givers are inclined to see the potential in everyone. By default, givers start by viewing people as bloomers. This is exactly what has enabled C.J. Skender to develop so many star students. He isn't unusual in recognizing talented people. He simply starts by seeing everyone as talented and tries to bring out the best in them. In Skender's mind, every student who walks into his classroom is a diamond in the rough, able and willing to be mined, cut, and polished. He sees potential where others don't, which has set in motion a series of self-fulfilling prophecies. Polishing the diamond in the rough. In 1985, a student of Skender's named Marie Arcuri sat for the CPA exam. She wasn't a good standardized test taker, and she didn't pass the first time. A few days later, she received a letter in the mail from Skender. He wrote to every single student who had taken the exam, congratulating those who passed and encouraging those who didn't. For the past quarter century, Marie has saved the letter. Your husband, family, and friends love you because of the beautiful person you have made yourself, not because of a performance on an examination. Remember that. Focus on November. Concentrate on practice. I want what's best for you. You will get through this thing, Marie. I write on my tests. The primary purpose has already been served by your preparation for this exam. Success doesn't measure a human being. Effort does. Studies show that accountants are more likely to achieve their potential when they receive the type of encouragement that Skender provided. Several years ago, 72 new auditors joined a Big Four accounting firm. Half of the auditors were randomly assigned to receive information that they had high potential to succeed. The study was led by researcher Brian McNatt, who had a doctorate, 2 accounting degrees, a CPA certification, and 5 years of experience as an accountant and auditor. McNatt read the resumes of the auditors who were randomly assigned to believe in their potential. Then he met with each of the auditors and informed them that they were hired after a highly competitive selection process, management had high expectations for their success, and they had the skills to overcome challenges and be successful. 3 weeks later, McNatt sent them a letter reinforcing this message. For a full month, the auditors who received McNatt's message earned higher performance ratings than the auditors in the control group, who never met with McNatt or received a letter from him. This was true even after controlling for the auditor's intelligence test scores and college grades. This is the effect that Skender's letter had on Marie Arcurie. He encouraged her to believe in her potential and set high expectations for her to succeed. He saw the best in his students, and still sees the best in his students, Marie says. She took the exam again and passed 2 sections, leaving 2 more to go. Along the way, Skender continued encouraging her. He wasn't going to let me slack off one bit. He would call me and check in on my progress. She passed the final section and earned her CPA in 1987, 2 years after she started taking the 4 sections of the exam. The difference he made in my life was in making sure my priorities were in order, keeping me on track and preventing me from throwing in the towel, Marie explains. I knew how much he'd invested in me, and I was not going to let him down. Today, Marie owns 2 Lexus automobile dealerships. The accounting background and the skills in reading financial statements have been valuable. But more than CJ taught me material for my job, he built my character, my passion, and my determination. His commitment to making sure that I got through led me to realize that I'd rather be defined by perseverance than by whether or not I passed an exam. Skender's approach contrasts with the basic model most companies follow when it comes to leadership development. Identify high potential people and then provide them with the mentoring support and resources needed to grow to achieve their potential. To identify these high potential future leaders, each year companies spend billions of dollars assessing and evaluating talent. Despite the popularity of this model, givers recognize that it is fatally flawed in one respect. The identification of talent may be the wrong place to start. For many years, psychologists believed that in any domain, success depended on talent first and motivation second. To groom world-class athletes and musicians, experts looked for people with the right raw abilities, and then sought to motivate them. If you want to find people who can dunk like Michael Jordan or play piano like Beethoven, it's only natural to start by screening candidates for leaping ability and an ear for music. But in recent years, psychologists have come to believe that this approach may be backward. In the 1960s, a pioneering psychologist named Raymond Cattell developed an investment theory of intelligence. He proposed that interest is what drives people to invest their time and energy in developing particular skills and bases of knowledge. Today, we have compelling evidence that interest precedes the development of talent. It turns out that motivation is the reason that people develop talent in the first place. In the 1980s, the psychologist Benjamin Bloom led a landmark study of world-class musicians, scientists, and athletes. Bloom's team interviewed 21 concert pianists who were finalists in major international competitions. When the researchers began to dig into the eminent pianist's early experiences with music, they discovered an unexpected absence of raw talent. The study showed that early on, most of the star pianists seemed special only when comparing one child with others in the family or neighborhood. They didn't stand out on a local, regional, or national level, and they didn't win many early competitions. When Bloom's team interviewed the world-class pianists and their parents, they stumbled upon another surprise. The pianists didn't start out learning from piano teachers who were experts. They typically took their first piano lessons with a teacher who lived nearby, in their neighborhoods. In The Talent Code, Daniel Coyle writes that, from a scientific perspective, it was as if the researchers had traced the lineage of the world's most beautiful swans back to a scruffy flock of barnyard chickens. Over time, even without an expert teacher at the outset, the pianists managed to become the best musicians in the world. The pianists gained their advantage by practicing many more hours than their peers. As Malcolm Gladwell showed us in Outliers, research led by psychologist Anders Ericsson reveals that attaining expertise in a domain typically requires 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. But what motivates people to practice at such length in the first place? This is where givers often enter the picture. When the pianist and their parents talked about their first piano teachers, they consistently focused on one theme. The teachers were caring, kind, and patient. The pianist looked forward to piano lessons because their first teachers made music interesting and fun. The children had very positive experiences with their first lessons. They made contact with another adult outside their home who was warm, supportive, and loving, Bloom's team explains. The world-class pianists had their initial interest sparked by teachers who were givers. The teachers looked for ways to make piano lessons enjoyable, which served as an early catalyst for the intense practice necessary to develop expertise. Exploring possibilities and engaging in a wide variety of musical activities took precedence over factors such as right or wrong or good or bad. The same patterns emerged for world-class tennis players. When Bloom's team interviewed 18 American tennis players who had been ranked in the top 10 in the world, they found that although their first coaches were not exceptional coaches, they tended to be very good with young children. What this first coach provided was motivation for the child to become interested in tennis and to spend time practicing. In roles as leaders and mentors, givers resist the temptation to search for talent first. By recognizing that anyone can be a bloomer, givers focus their attention on motivation. The top-ranked tennis players tended to have a first coach who took a special interest in the tennis player, Bloom's team notes, usually because he perceived the player as being motivated and willing to work hard, rather than because of any special physical abilities. In the accounting classroom, looking for motivation and work ethic, not only intellectual ability, is part of what made C.J. Skinder so successful in recognizing talent. When Skinder bet Beth Tranum that she would pass the CPA exam, it wasn't because she was unusually gifted in accounting. It was because he noticed how hard she worked all semester. When Skinder recognized that Reggie Love had promise, whereas others wrote him off as just another jock. It was because Love worked diligently and was always prepared for class, Skender says. He was interested in learning and bettering himself. When Skender encouraged Marie Arcuri, it was because she was the most involved and committed individual I have ever met. Her persistence set her apart. The psychologist Angela Duckworth calls this grit, having passion and perseverance toward long-term goals. Her research shows that above and beyond intelligence and aptitude, gritty people, by virtue of their interest, focus, and drive, achieve higher performance. Persistence is incredibly important, says psychologist Tom Kolditz, a brigadier general who headed up behavioral sciences and leadership at the U.S. Military Academy for a dozen years. The standard selection rate for Army officers to key command positions is 12%. Kolditz's former faculty have been selected at rates as high as 75%, and he chalks much of it up to selecting candidates based on grit. As George Anders writes in The Rare Find, you can't take motivation for granted. Of course, natural talent also matters. But once you have a pool of candidates above the threshold of necessary potential, grit is a major factor that predicts how close they get to achieving their potential. This is why givers focus on gritty people. It's where givers have the greatest return on their investment, the most meaningful and lasting impact. And along with investing their time in motivating gritty people, givers like Skender strive to cultivate grit in the first place. Setting high expectations is so important, Skender says. You have to push people, make them stretch and do more than they think possible. When they take my tests, I want them thinking it was the toughest exam they've ever seen in their lives. It makes them better learners. To encourage effort, he gives them a half dozen past exams for practice. They need to make a significant investment, and it pays off. Forcing them to work harder than they ever have in their lives benefits them in the long run. One of the keys to cultivating grit is making the task at hand more interesting and motivating. In Bloom's study, across the board, the talented musicians and athletes were initially taught by givers, teachers who liked children and rewarded them with praise, signs of approval, or even candy when they did anything right. They were extremely encouraging. They were enthusiastic about the talent field and what they had to teach these children. In many cases, they treated the child as a friend of the family might. Perhaps the major quality of these teachers was that they made the initial learning very pleasant and rewarding. This description could have been written about Skender. At first glance, he seems to fit the stereotype of an accounting whiz. But at various stages in his life, Skender aspired to be a disc jockey, musician, actor, talk show host, and stand-up comedian. Set foot in his classroom, and you'll see that he hasn't quite given up on these dreams. True to his compulsive nature and eclectic taste, he punctuates his courses with entertaining routines to keep his students engaged, playing four songs at the start of each class and tossing candy bars to the first students who shout out the correct answers to music trivia. This is how a poster of a rapper ended up on his wall. If you want to engage your audience, if you really want to grab their attention, you have to know the world they live in, the music they listen to, the movies they watch, he explains. To most of these kids, accounting is like a root canal. But when they hear me quote Usher or CeeLo Green, they say to themselves, whoa, did that fat old white-haired guy just say what I thought he said? And then you've got him. By cultivating interest in accounting, Skender believes that his students will be more likely to invest the time and energy necessary to master the discipline. CJ is the epitome of someone who is emphatic, Reggie Love says. He knows more about music than anyone, and he's always able to weave it into the lecture to help people connect with the material. When you think about having to take a hard course, which typically isn't very interesting, having to keep up with it is challenging. CJ made it interesting, and I ended up working harder as a result. Love earned an A in Skender's class. David Maltz, a former student of Skender's, who works at Google, elaborates that Skender helps every single student and person he comes across in any way possible. He sacrifices hundreds of hours of his personal life to make an impact on the lives of students and teach as many of them as possible. He goes out of his way to make everyone that he engages with feel special. Throwing good money after bad talent. Because they see potential all around them, givers end up investing a lot of their time in encouraging and developing people to achieve this potential. These investments don't always pay off. Some candidates lack the raw talent, and others don't sustain their passion or maintain the requisite level of grit. Skender once wrote more than 100 recommendation letters for a student who was applying to graduate programs outside of accounting. She was rejected by all of the programs in her first year, and she decided to apply again. So he dutifully rewrote the recommendation letters. When the schools turned her down once more, Skender revised his recommendation letters for a third year in a row. Finally, after three strikes, Skender encouraged her to pursue a different route. If Skender were more of a taker or a matcher, would he have given up sooner, saving his own time and the students? Do givers overinvest in people who possess loads of passion but fall short on aptitude? And how do they manage their priorities to focus on people who show promise while investing less in those who don't? To find out, there's nowhere better to look than professional basketball, where the annual NBA draft tests talent experts on an international stage. The late Stu Inman is remembered as the man behind two of the worst draft mistakes in the history of the National Basketball Association. In 1972, the Portland Trail Blazers had the first pick in the draft. Inman was serving as the director of player personnel, and he picked center LaRue Martin, who turned out to be a disappointment, averaging just over 5 points and 4 rebounds per game in 4 seasons with the Blazers. In drafting Martin, Inman passed up two of the greatest players in NBA history. The second pick that year was Bob McAdoo, who scored more points in his first season than Martin did in his entire career. McAdoo was named Rookie of the Year, and 2 years later, he was the NBA's most valuable player. In his 14-year NBA career, McAdoo won the league's scoring title twice, played on 2 championship teams, and made 5 All-Star teams. In that draft, Inman also missed out on Julius Erving, better known as Dr. J, who was selected 12th. Erving ended up leading teams to 3 championships, winning 4 MVP awards, making 16 All-Star teams, and becoming one of the top 5 leading scorers in the history of professional basketball. Both McAdoo and Erving are members of the Basketball Hall of Fame. A dozen years later, after being promoted to general manager of the Blazers, Stu Inman had the chance to redeem himself. In the 1984 NBA draft, Inman had the second pick. He chose another center, Sam Bowie, who was over 7 feet tall, but athletic and coordinated. He could shoot, pass, and steal, not to mention block shots and grab rebounds. But Bowie never lived up to his potential. When he retired from basketball, ESPN named him the worst draft pick in the history of North American professional sports. In 2003, Sports Illustrated, whose cover Bowie had graced years earlier, called him the second biggest draft flop in the history of the NBA. The biggest? LaRue Martin. In selecting Bowie second, Inman passed up on a shooting guard from North Carolina named Michael Jordan. With the third pick, the Chicago Bulls selected Jordan. And the rest is history. After being named Rookie of the Year, Jordan racked up 6 championships, 10 scoring titles, and 11 MVP awards, while making 14 All-Star teams and averaging more points than any player ever. He was recognized as the greatest North American athlete of the 20th century by ESPN. Inman recognized Jordan's potential, but the Blazers already had 2 strong guards. They needed a center, so he drafted Sam Bowie. With that choice, he didn't just miss out on Michael Jordan. He also passed up future Hall of Famers Charles Barkley, drafted 5th, and John Stockton, drafted 16th. It was bad enough that Inman chose Martin over McAdoo and Irving, and Bowie over Jordan, Barkley, and Stockton. But drafting professional basketball players is at best an imperfect science, and even great managers and coaches make mistakes. What was worse was that the Blazers held on to both players far longer than they should have. They kept LaRue Martin for 4 seasons, and by the time they decided to trade him, he had virtually no value. The Blazers couldn't even get an actual player in exchange for Martin. They gave him away in exchange for future considerations from the Seattle Supersonics, who ended up letting him go before the season even started. That was the end of Martin's basketball career, and it was an embarrassing outcome for Inman. "It was a sore subject," said Jack Ramsey, who was the Blazers coach in Martin's last year and now serves as an ESPN analyst. "Because LaRue couldn't play. He was trying to make the team when I got there, but we had no place for him. He had no offensive game, and he wasn't a rebounder or shot blocker, even though he was 6'11", so he had no skills." The Blazers followed a similar path with Sam Bowie. In 1989, after 5 lackluster seasons, the Blazers finally traded Bowie to the New Jersey Nets. Why did the Blazers hold on to Sam Bowie and LaRue Martin for so long? Stu Inman was widely known as a giver. After playing college basketball and coaching high school basketball for a few years, Inman made the leap to college coach, eventually becoming the head coach of his alma mater, San Jose State. In this role, Inman seemed to prioritize players' interests ahead of his own success. One of Inman's star recruits was Tommy Smith, an exceptional athlete who came to San Jose State to run track and play football and basketball. On the freshman basketball team, Smith was the top scorer and rebounder, so in his sophomore year, he began practicing with the varsity basketball team under Inman. One day, Smith came by Inman's office and announced that he was going to quit basketball to focus on track. "I thought he was going to blow up at me," Smith writes, "but he didn't." Coach Inman said, "Okay, Tom, I understand." He shook my hand and told me to be sure to come by and see him whenever I wanted to, and that I was always welcome back if I changed my mind. That was the greatest thing in the world for me. It wasn't so great for Inman. Smith's speed could have added a great deal to the San Jose basketball team. A few years later, in 1968, Smith won the Olympic gold medal in the 200-meter dash, setting a world record. But Inman had wanted what was best for Smith. Along with letting top talent walk away, Inman made room for gritty players, even if they lacked talent. When a skinny white player named Terry Murphy tried out for the varsity team, Inman respected his work ethic and invited him on board. Murphy recalls being one of the worst players Inman had ever coached. "I scored 4 points the whole year." Despite this lackluster performance, Inman told Murphy, "I'm never going to cut you. You're enthusiastic, and you play hard, and you're a good guy." Inman was continually giving advice to any basketball junkie who sought it, writes Wayne Thompson, a reporter who covered the Blazers throughout Inman's tenure. He couldn't help it. "Teaching at any level on any subject is the most rewarding thing you can do," Inman told Thompson. "I just love to see the expression on the face of a student who gets it for the first time. Just watching the learning process come to full bloom gives me such a rush." Once Inman developed a positive impression of players, was he too committed to teaching and developing them, so much that he invested in motivated players even if they lacked the requisite talent? In the classroom, C.J. Skinder can afford to dedicate his time to students who demonstrate interest and drive, as he can teach and mentor a large number of students each semester. Conversely, in professional basketball and most work organizations, we face more limits. Making a bet on one person's potential means passing on others. Inman had made a commitment to developing Larue Martin and Sam Bowie. If Inman had been more of a taker, doesn't it seem obvious that he would have cut his losses much more quickly and moved on to other players? The moment he realized that Martin and Bowie weren't contributing to his team's success, a taker wouldn't feel any sense of responsibility to them. And if Inman had been more of a matcher, wouldn't he have been more willing to let them go? Surely a matcher would grow frustrated that his investments in Martin and Bowie were not being reciprocated or rewarded. It might seem that givers have a harder time letting go, but in reality, the exact opposite is true. It turns out that givers are the least vulnerable to the mistakes of overinvesting in people, and that being a giver is what prevented Stu Inman from making far worse mistakes. Facing the mirror, looking good or doing good? Barry Straw is a world-renowned organizational behavior professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and he has spent his career trying to understand why people make bad decisions in organizations. In an ingenious study, Straw and Ha Ha Wong collected data on all 240-plus players who were picked in the first two rounds of the NBA draft between 1980 and 1986 in hopes of seeing what effect draft position had on a player's career. They measured each player's performance with a series of different metrics: scoring, points per minute, field goal percentage, and free throw percentage; toughness, rebounds and blocks per minute; and quickness, assists, and steals per minute. Straw and Ha Wong controlled for each player's performance on all of these metrics, as well as for the player's injuries and illnesses, whether the player was a guard, forward, or center, and the quality of the player's team based on win-loss records. Then they examined how much time on the court the players received and how long their teams kept them before trading them, to see if teams made the mistake of over-investing in players just because they drafted them early. The results produced a devastating conclusion. Teams couldn't let go of their big bets. They stuck with the players whom they drafted early, giving them more playing time and refusing to trade them even if they played poorly. After taking performance out of the equation, players who were drafted earlier still spent more minutes on the court and were less likely to be traded. For every slot higher in the draft, players were given an average of 22 more minutes in their second season, and their teams were still investing more in them by their fifth season, when each draft slot higher accounted for 11 more minutes on the court. And for every slot higher in the draft, players were 3% less likely to be traded. This study is a classic case of what Straw calls escalation of commitment to a losing course of action. Over the past four decades, extensive research led by Straw shows that once people make an initial investment of time, energy, or resources, when it goes sour, they're at risk for increasing their investment. Gamblers in the hole believe that if they just play one more hand of poker, they'll be able to recover their losses or even win big. Struggling entrepreneurs think that if they just give their startups a little more sweat, they can turn it around. When an investment doesn't pay off, even if the expected value is negative, we invest more. Economists explain this behavior using a concept known as the sunk cost fallacy. When estimating the value of a future investment, we have trouble ignoring what we've already invested in the past. Sunk costs are part of the story. But new research shows that other factors matter more. To figure out why and when escalation of commitment happens, researchers at Michigan State University analyzed 166 different studies.